Good morning, and welcome to our third study on the book of Job. We're now going to look at chapter 32 onwards. Job's three friends have long since fallen silent. They have no reply to Job's argument. If Job is speaking the truth about his innocence, then his complaint is unanswerable, at least in terms of their theory of retribution. So the debate here between Job and his friends has reached an insoluble impasse. And it's to that point that this brilliant, inspired poet who composed Job wanted to bring us. Now, I have suggested in previous weeks that this poet has an underlying purpose in writing this epic we call Job. He wants to expose the inadequacy of the orthodox theology of his day. The orthodox theology might be okay as a generalization, but it had no answers to cases like Job. It had no answer to the problem of innocent suffering. And when the three friends fall silent before Job's relentless logic, the poet wants us to see that the orthodox theology of his day lies also dumbfounded. In the poet's view, there has to be a new insight, a new approach, if this vexed question of innocent suffering is to be answered. And in these concluding chapters, chapters 32 onwards, I think the poet is trying to provide us with at least the beginnings of that new insight, that new approach that he saw we needed. And he has three responses to offer us, and he presents them in succession. The first response is directed to our minds, a new understanding of the purpose of suffering, and that forms the central core of the speeches of Elihu. The second response is directed to our hearts, and it points us to a fresh experience of the majesty of God. That's chapters 38 to 41. And the third response is directed to mind and heart together and provides a new assurance of final vindication for the innocent sufferer. And that's chapter 42. So let's look at these responses. The answer he provides for the benefit of our minds, a new understanding of the purpose of suffering. And I take that to be the goal of the Elihu speeches. Look at chapter 32, verses 1 to 3. So, it says, these three men stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. But Elihu, son of Barachel the Buzite, of the family of Ram, became very angry with Job for justifying himself rather than God. He was also angry with the three friends because they had found no way to refute Job and yet had condemned him. Now, some of you who may have read commentaries on Job will know that the Elihu speeches are the source of considerable controversy. In fact, the majority of scholars regard these speeches as what they call an interpolation, that is, added to the book of Job sometime after the original completion of Job. Now, the reasons for that are various, but one of the major reasons is that they argue that Elihu says nothing new. He doesn't add anything to the debate. They argue that he simply reiterates the argument of the three friends, as for instance in chapter 34, verses 10 to 12. Just look at with those verses with me. So listen to me, you men of understanding, Far be it from God to do evil, from the Almighty to do wrong. He repays a man for what he has done. He brings upon him what his conduct deserves. It is unthinkable that God would do wrong, that the Almighty would pervert justice. What's that, they say, but another dogmatic statement of the theory of exact divine retribution, which Job has so successfully discredited. They then say that this Elihu speech must be the work of some later poet who was shocked by Job's later final remarks, and his later poet was determined that orthodoxy should have the last word. Well, I can't go into all the arguments, it'd be too long. But suffice it to say that if you look at these speeches carefully, you will discover that the writer of them certainly believes he is casting fresh light on the problem and claims so. Look at chapter 32, verse 3. Far from being merely an echo of those earlier opinions, Elihu is presented as someone who wants to disassociate himself from the three friends, and that becomes even clearer. Look at chapter 32, verses 11 and 12. I waited while you spoke. I listened to your reasoning while you were searching for words. I gave you my full attention, but not one of you has proved Job wrong. None of you has answered his arguments. In other words, Elihu is saying to these three friends, although you won't admit it, Job has beaten you. Your line of argument has run into the sand. You are reduced to a feeble, we know we are right, even if we can't prove it. Like we said last week, they bury their heads in the sand. But Elihu will not give way to such obscurantist tactics. He's convinced something can be said in reply to Job. But it involves taking to task not only Job himself, but also the three friends in different regards. You see, on the one hand, Elihu insists that the justice of God in his dealings with men must be upheld. He won't give way on that. If we allow Job to cast doubt on that, then biblical faith becomes indefensible. And in that sense, Elihu does support the argument of the three friends, as we saw in chapter 34. It is unthinkable that God would do wrong, that the Almighty would pervert justice. We can't let Job win on that point. But on the other hand, you see, Elihu is not prepared to turn a blind eye to the fact of innocent suffering, as the three friends have done. Elihu believes there is an explanation of Job's plight, which is consistent with the justice of God, but does not require us to insist that Job's suffering is due to some sin in his life. Now, it's that new and different explanation that Elihu proceeds to expound in the course of his four speeches. Just look at chapter 33 and verses 8 to 14 with me. But you have said in my hearing, I heard the very words, I am pure and without sin, I am clean and free from guilt, yet God has found fault with me. He considers me his enemy. He fastens my feet in shackles. He keeps close watch on all my paths. But I tell you, in this you are not right, for God is greater than man. Why do you complain to him that he answers none of man's words? For God does speak, now one way, now another, though man may not perceive it. Well, I want you to notice in those words is what Elihu does not say. He does not insist that Job is lying in his claims to be innocent. No, in Elihu's mind, Job's mistake lies not in the sinfulness of his past life, but in the misrepresentation he's putting on his present suffering. Brainwashed, no doubt, by the theory of retribution current in his day, Job has taken it for granted that if God is treating him in this unfortunate way, then it must mean that God is hostile to him. Look at 33 verse 10. He considers me his enemy, says Job. It stands to reason God will never treat a friend like that. But you see, Elihu does not accept that line of logic. You're wrong, Job, to interpret what has happened as necessarily a sign of divine anger. What you've got to realize, Job, is two things. First, God is much bigger than you think. His purposes are much grander than you think. He's above the petty spite that you attribute to him. You attribute it to God only because your idea of God is too much conditioned by your experience of other humans. No, God is greater than man. And secondly, he says, God is much more eager to communicate with you than you think. He's concerned for your welfare. He's much more sincere than you give him credit for. You complain of his indifference only because you're not listening appropriately to his voice. For God does speak, now one way, now another, though man may not perceive it. Well, the questions are obvious. What is this greater purpose that God has in suffering? How are his words falling on deaf ears? Well, Elihu explains in chapter 33, verse 15. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men as they slumber in their beds, he may speak in their ears, terrify them with warnings, to turn man from wrongdoing and to keep him from pride, to preserve his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. God's greater purpose, says Elihu, is to prevent you, Job, from perishing in hell, to preserve your soul from the pit. And ironically enough, says Elihu, God is trying to communicate right now with you, Job, to that end, through these sufferings which you are complaining of. Now, there's no doubt this is a new perspective. What Elihu is saying here is that God uses negative experiences in people's lives not only as a retribution for past crimes, but as a preventative tool against future waywardness. Even in the lives of the righteous, he says, there is a danger of falling into sin. In particular, there's an ever-present temptation to complacency and pride. So God disciplines us through various kinds of suffering. Even those who are not guilty of any major wrongdoing, he disciplines in this way in order to prevent such spiritual catastrophes in the future in their lives. And sometimes, Elihu says, God does this through psychological suffering, like nightmares. Verse 15 of chapter 33, you wake up in the middle of the night, a cold sweat. Sometimes God does this through physical suffering, verse 19 of chapter 33. Sometimes God warns us, verse 22 of chapter 33, about what we would call a near-death experience. However God chooses to speak, his purpose in such negative experiences is not necessarily to punish, but to chasten. So that man may be rescued out of the sinful arrogance of which he sometimes was in danger. And the man may be able to testify instead to a humility of heart. And Elihu says this is God's regular policy. And note, Job, that God does not treat us like this because he is angry with us. On the contrary, his purpose is to deliver us. Look at verse 30 of chapter 33. To turn back his soul from the pit, that the light of life may shine on him. Well, the implication of Elihu's argument is clear. Your problem, Job, is not failure to repent of past sins. Your problem is your failure to learn from present suffering. In your anger about God's dealings with you, you do stand in danger of precisely the self-righteous pride which your suffering is meant to get rid of or get out of you. And in all of Elihu's four speeches, this is a constant theme. You can find it in chapter 36, verse 15, and chapter 36, verses 21 to 22. Now, the three friends earlier in the book centered their thoughts on suffering as divine retribution. Who is a judge like God, they say? That's their viewpoint. But Elihu introduces here the thought of suffering as divine instruction. Who is a teacher like God? That's the question Elihu asks. We ask, why me, Lord? Well, the answer of Elihu is really the same answer as the book of Hebrews gives in the New Testament. Endure hardship as a discipline. God is treating you as sons, the writer to the Hebrews says. Suffering has a positive side to it for those who receive it as instruction and have listened to what God has had to teach them through it. Don't despair, says the writer to the Hebrews. Don't despair when the Lord rebukes you, because the Lord only rebukes, only disciplines, only trains those he loves, and he chastens every son he receives. And again, you can see in the Bible, it is God's greatest saints who have to suffer. Even the Apostle Paul had a thorn in the flesh, which God would not take away, no matter how many times Paul prayed to take it away. You see, it was given to stop Paul becoming arrogant. It was given to stop Paul becoming too big for his boots. And maybe the same is for us. Suffering is not always a divine judgment. It is often intended as a divine instruction. And do you know that the writer to the Hebrews even tells us that Jesus, who was sinless and perfect, learned obedience through the things he suffered? He could only learn it by receiving the suffering as the instruction from his Father. So then, God then has things to teach us through suffering. But Elihu would have us know that we will not learn those things whilst we are like Job, who is hiding behind, I think in Elihu's view, behind the barricades of righteous indignation or wallowing in self-pity. Now, sometimes, you see, we talk about suffering in silence. What people don't realize is that there are two kinds of such suffering in silence. There is the angry, resentful, sulking silence, or there is the submissive, chastened, attentive suffering of a child who is hurt by their father's discipline but wants to understand, wants to listen as to what's it all about. And that's our inspired author's first response to this huge problem of suffering God teaches us through suffering. Now that brings me to the second response, a fresh experience of the majesty of God. Just turn to chapter 38 and these famous words from verse 1 onwards. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me." Martin Luther, the great Reformation preacher, is reported to have criticized the scholar Erasmus, saying this, "Erasmus, your thoughts of God are too human." I suppose a similar rebuke lies at the heart of these final chapters. Elihu has already told Job that God is greater than man. And no doubt Job would have agreed with him, theologically speaking. But it's one thing, isn't it, to believe a truth intellectually, and it's another thing altogether to feel a truth experientially. Part of Job's problem, rather like Erasmus, I suggest, was that he had been over-influenced by rationalism. A rationalist is a person who thinks there is a total explanation available to human understanding for everything that happens. The three friends we've been talking about were rationalists. According to their philosophy, the workings of God's justice was fully intelligible to the human mind. It was a law of cause and effect, much like the law of gravity. It always worked. You could fully understand what God was doing in any situation by this theory of retribution. And Job had accepted that presupposition, even if he questioned the conclusions that arose out of it. It was because he accepted that those rationalistic presuppositions that he felt he was able to argue with God. "I've got my arguments," he said. "I've got my reasons. Where are God's?" He wanted a rational explanation for his suffering. Up to a point, that ambition for a rational explanation was not misplaced. That's the point of Elihu's speeches. Elihu makes it plain that it is not impossible to give a reasoned account of innocent suffering. Suffering can have a positive and saving effect in the lives of people once we realize it's a loving discipline rather than assuming it implies divine judgment. But such a rational interpretation of suffering on its own is not enough. In fact, with some justice, you could call it cold comfort. Children dead, business collapsing. Just ask yourself, what is God teaching you through all of this? Expressed in that way, you can see it's trite, it's crass even. It may be true, but for a person who's actually immersed in the bitterness of suffering, it won't do, will it? Those who are suffering in their hearts long for something more than mere reasons. They are yearning for something deeper than theological explanations. The person who is truly suffering longs for God, the living God, for a first-hand experience of the felt presence of God, for a personal relationship with God. "Oh, that I know where I might find him." That's Job's cry. And then these climactic concluding chapters, what God offers Job is the answer to that quest. Now, in these final chapters, I want you to notice God does not criticize Job for any past sins. He does not deny Job's protested innocence. I also want you to notice that God does not address Job's repeated requests for an explanation. God offers no rational justification for Job's suffering. Instead, God deluges Job with unanswerable questions and ironic challenges. An unanswerable barrage goes on. Does Job understand the fundamental forces of the universe? Can Job unravel the mystery of creation? We have four chapters of classic exposition of the wonders of God's world, drawn from cosmology through to zoology. And what's God's point in all of this? Is he, as some have said, trying to convince Job that there's a rational order in the universe, a framework of universal logic, a framework of scientific law that is able to provide human beings both an explanation of the phenomena in a way that's fully satisfying to our minds? Well, no. If you read these passages carefully, the purpose is quite to the contrary. Many aspects of creation are selected which testify to the total mystery of so much of God's world and its apparent total irrelevance for any purpose that God may have for human beings. I mean, why does God bother himself with the wild animals of the desert, the distant stars? Why the ostrich? Why so much of creation appear utterly pointless as Job's suffering? But does that mean there's no wisdom in it all? No grand design? No ultimate purpose? No, of course it doesn't. The point of the Creator, God's questions to Job, is that as far as we human beings are concerned, it is an inscrutable wisdom that governs this universe. It is a hidden design. It is a secret purpose that controls its destiny. Look with me at chapter 40, verses 6 to 14. And then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? And can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and majesty, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty, unless unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them in all the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your right hand can save you. If you think you have the right to understand everything that happens to you, then why not go the whole way and govern the universe yourself, Job? If you can do that, says God, I will furnish you with an explanation. If you could rule the world, Job, you would be me. You would be God. You would be your own deliverer. Now, back in the 1930s, George Bernard Shaw wrote one of the strongest defenses of atheism. He called it The Adventures of a Black Girl in Search of God. Now, if you ever read that book, in that book, Shaw scorns the God who speaks in these chapters. He scorns this God, as a bad debater. God saves himself from defeat at Job's hands, says Shaw, by the old trick. When your case is weak, shout louder. Job has asked for an explanation for the problem of innocent suffering. How can a just God allow it? And says Shaw, it is no valid reply to jeer at Job because Job cannot catch a crocodile. The answer to Job is not an intelligent answer, says George Bernard Shaw. Just saying you can't do this, you can't do that, so I'm not going to explain it to you, is not adequate. Now, I have to say, I find it quite easy initially to sympathize with Shaw's dissatisfaction. And yet, I suspect Shaw's hostile reaction to these chapters in Job go a long way to explain why, in all probability, Shaw is lost for eternity. Shaw's problem, you see, like Job's, like the three friends, had been too much influenced by rationalism. He too wanted the universe to be fully intelligible to man. Any kind of appeal to mystery, for sure, was anti-intellectual, a cop-out, not an answer, just a sneer. And as long as, like Shaw, we insist that God must give us a rational justification of the way he runs the universe before we are prepared to believe in him, then like Shaw, we shall never find God. You see, for a God who is fully explicable to man is, as Luther said to Erasmus, an all too human God. And a too human God is an unnecessary God. What do we need a God like that for? We can replace him with our own science. Now, the God of the Bible does address himself to human reason. That's true. He inspires the prophets to interpret his ways to men. And in that way, we can dare to say we understand God. We have intellectual insight into God's character. We can even talk about theology, the knowledge of God. But if we think that that means God owes us an explanation of everything he does, or that such explanation could be accessible to our finite minds, then we are wrong. In fact, we are worse than wrong. We are proud. Arrogant rationalists, like Job, have to be brought to a humble view of their own intelligence and of their own insignificance. Do you see how Job ends up in chapter 42, verses 2 to 6? I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears have heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now, that's a rather different man from the one who said in verse 31, chapter 31 and verses 35 to 37, these words. Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing. Surely I would wear it on my shoulder. I should put it on like a crown. I would give him an account of my every step. Like a prince, I would approach him. Very different from chapter 42, isn't it? Now, I want to ask the question, have you ever stood where Job stands in chapter 42, verses 2 to 6. Have you ever taken on your lips words like that? Have you ever felt with Job this extraordinary sense of wonder and worship, which at once hurls us into a humiliating sense of our own insignificance, and yet simultaneously summons us by some inner rapture into personal communication with this God who exceeds our comprehension? You see, Job knew all about God theoretically. That's what he means when he says, "My ears had heard of you." But that knowledge of God had not helped him. In the hour of suffering, he found theory about God was not enough. And let me tell you, we will find the same. Nothing on earth will satisfy with regard to innocent suffering. Only a real encounter with God. Only personal experience knowledge will do. And that's what Job finds. And he says, "But my eyes have seen you." Instead, he learned the futility of thinking he had any rights to answers. Now, believe Job. Believe Job in the sense of that he came to a place, the only place a suffering person can find peace, can find rest, and that is in finding God himself.